Well, good morning. My name is Matt. I have the privilege of being minister here at Maybridge. So if we haven't met, let me add my welcome to you as well. Do continue to make yourself at home. I'm just aware with obviously what we've done already in this service, and I know what I'm about to talk about. This is quite a emotionally intense service this morning. I'm just going to pray before I continue, if that's all right. Father God, thank you for the wonderful, powerful words that we've just sung. Nothing can take us out of your hands. And we thank you that you're a God who is personal. There's so many ways of seeing the world that people have, but we believe in a God who is personal, a God who gets it, a God who knows what it is to have emotions. And sometimes maybe we forget that. And I thank you that you're alongside us today and all days in our ups and downs. You understand what our experience is. And Lord, as we now turn to looking at some stuff in the Bible, I thank you that this is not detached from our experiences, but it sheds light on them. And more than that, it sheds light on what you're like. And ultimately, that is wonderful. Amen. Well, we've been journeying through Matthew's Gospel in the New Testament for about 3 years on and off. This incredible text, one of the most influential things ever written in the history of the world, an eyewitness account of Jesus' life. And we're now in the last few chapters where it all comes to a head, basically. Jesus, where we find him in this story, has by this time ministered and taught and healed people for around also 3 years, about as long as this series. So that gives you some sense of scale if you've been here all that time. Now he's in the capital city, Jerusalem. It's the night before he's going to get crucified. This world-shattering, universe-changing event. But nobody else knows that. And Jesus, we find in this passage, he's with his closest followers in Gethsemane, which is a garden on the edge of the city of Jerusalem. It's still there today, actually. I've just pressed the clicker, but it's not done anything. Fiona, I might need your help because the clicker got dropped on the floor earlier in the service. It may not be working now. I don't know. Gethsemane. Has anyone been to Gethsemane? It's incredible, isn't it? Because it's like when you have a tour guide, they say basically it's pretty much what it would have been 2,000 years ago. So it would have looked like this. And some of the trees may even be that old, which is phenomenal. Anyway, let's read what happens there. And I want to tell you why this is incredible, this story. I'm excited to talk about this. And it speaks to every one of us, what we're going to read. And it confronts us with the reality of how much God loves us. Okay, so here we are. Then Jesus went with his disciples to a place called Gethsemane. And he said to them, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." He took Peter and the two sons of Zebedee along with him, and he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me." Going a little farther, he fell with his face to the ground and prayed, "My Father, if it's possible, may this cup be taken from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will." Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. "Couldn't you men keep watch with me for 1 hour?" He asked Peter. "Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." He went away a second time and prayed, "My Father, if it's not possible for this cup to be taken away unless I drink it, may your will be done." When he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. So he left them and went away once more and prayed the third time, saying the same thing. Then he returned to the disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Look, the hour has come, and the Son of Man is delivered into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer." Now, after everything that we've seen so far in this book, if you've been around for it, this passage might seem a bit surprising. Jesus suddenly seems somehow less heroic than he has before. He seems agitated. Surely, you know, if it's Jesus, you'd expect something different, wouldn't you? A lot of the world's other great martyrs died with their fist in the face of evil, defiantly saying, "Oh, I'm not afraid, bring it on. I'm not going to back down." Think of great movies that many of us will have seen, like Braveheart or Gladiator. Now, doesn't the martyred hero have to die with great strength and defiance? Come on, I'll take you on. Even through history, people have died in a similar way. When the great philosopher Socrates, for example, was killed, he was cool and stoic when he went to execution. He was given hemlock to drink. He showed no signs of fear, and he's even reported as cracking a few jokes. Strong to the end. Many Jewish heroes around the time of Jesus went to their martyrdom in a similar way, people like Spartacus and Maccabeus. Throughout history, many of Jesus' followers have died bravely and defiantly. One great story is about Polycarp, who had a great name, who was an early church leader and thinker. And when they came to arrest him, he was 86 years old. And he asked for a moment to pray, which he did very calmly. And they tied him to a stake and they asked him if he had any last words before they burned him. And he said in a loud voice to the crowd, "You think I'm afraid of this fire? It burns for a moment and it's gone. You should be afraid of the fires of hell. I'm not scared of these temporary flames. You should be afraid of the eternal ones. Come on, boys, bring on the fire." Now, that's a hero, right? That's what we think of a great martyr. That's what they should be doing, isn't it? And yet in this passage, Jesus, the Son of God, he knows it's coming. He approaches death very differently. He's trembling. He's upset. He's going backward and forward, it seems frantically, between God and his disciples. He's asking God, is there another way? Matthew, the author, even says that at one point he falls face down. He's so bothered, he drops to the ground. And what's really strange about this is that everywhere else, whenever you read about him, Jesus is the one who shows absolute courage in the face of danger. Right before this story, for example, Jesus' disciples are trying to persuade him not to go to Jerusalem because it's dangerous. But he says, no, it's my destiny. I need to go. We're going, okay? And right after this story, or soon after, he calmly faces the Roman leader Pontius Pilate, who's the man who can have him killed or set free. And throughout that, Jesus is just calm and collected and determined. So what's going on here? Why is Jesus the way that he is here? Early in the passage, it gives us a little clue. It says that as he prayed, Jesus began to be sorrowful and troubled. The word began, means that something began in that moment. Something started that moment. Jesus must have seen or experienced something while he was praying that astonished him. It began in that moment. The word translated sorrowful is a very strong Greek word that can mean horrified, especially when you combine it with the word troubled. One commentator on this says it indicates the kind of feeling that you would have, for example, if you came home one evening and found that all your family had been murdered. You'd be ripped apart from the inner being, wouldn't you? It's that sort of feeling that Jesus experiences while he's praying. Whatever it was so troubling that Jesus almost died from it in that moment. Jesus is not one who's prone to exaggeration, as we see of him throughout the Bible stories. Everything we know of him in the rest of this story tells us that this was not a man who was weak or easily bothered by anything, which must mean that in this moment, he saw something so horrifying, he literally almost died in the moment. In fact, in Luke's gospel, when it tells this story, it says that whatever Jesus saw or experienced caused him so much strain that he literally began to sweat drops of blood. Now, that might sound mad. Probably we've never seen that happen to anybody. There is a condition that medics have observed called hemetrodosis. Have I pronounced that right, darling? But basically, this is when you're under so much stress that your capillaries burst. You do literally sweat blood. And so here's Jesus, God come to earth, who spoke worlds into existence, who walked on waves, who calmed storms, who cast out demons, who healed diseases, who brought someone who was dead back to life. And he is so horrified by something that his capillaries burst, nearly causing death on the spot. What has troubled him? What was it? The real question is what he has not seen. In this passage, Jesus prays. He calls out to God his Father, which he's done thousands of times before throughout his life. But this time, for the first time, he gets no response. He calls God Abba, a term of great intimacy. But for the first time in all of eternity, the Father was silent when the Son spoke to him. See, here's what you have to know. Up to this point, Jesus has enjoyed the closest intimacy with God his Father. Forever. It's an intimacy that's known no beginning or end. The Father's always radiated with openness towards him. But now, for the first time, only silence. And so Jesus stumbles back to his disciples, it seems, looking for some sort of comfort. And he wakes them up. Guys, I need you right now. I need you to be with me. And of course, at his great moment of need, the disciples are not there to support him because they're asleep. Asleep while the most significant moment in history begins to unfold in front of them. Not that they know, of course. Asleep when heaven and hell are in the balance. And so Jesus goes back to his Father, saying the exact same thing. Father, if there's any other way, get me out of this. Let's try a different option. And again, only silence. What's happening? William Lane, a New Testament scholar, says that the only explanation for these events is that here, in Gethsemane, what Jesus does on the cross has begun in this moment. In this moment, God begins to turn his face away from his Son. What happens on the cross begins now. Before the first nail was driven into his body, Jesus' soul was experiencing abandonment by God. He'd lived his entire life with the approval of the Father, and now in the moment he wants his Father's presence most, God the Father turns his face away. And Jesus staggered under the weight of this, almost to the point of death. He's facing the abyss, the ultimate loneliness. I wonder if you've ever felt utterly alone. Maybe it's because of a terrible betrayal by someone, or maybe it's a dark period of your life. Maybe you've experienced extreme depression. Jesus felt like that. He knows what it's like. But more than that, he felt it a million times over because he lost the greatest closeness to the greatest extent. Ripped out of perfect relationship with his dad. Not just aloneness, but the experience of rejection. I think about what it would be like to turn away from one of my children in a moment when they needed me, to have them look at me in a moment of great pain or weakness, and me to turn away, effectively saying, I'm not with you at this moment. I'm not you're not my child. Can you imagine how crushing that would be? And yet my children have only known me for a few years, and I'm definitely not a perfect dad. What must it have been like to lose grasp of the Father that you've known from all eternity past? That's what Jesus experiences in the garden on the edge of the city. Is it possible to even describe this? I feel like there's nothing that will make us really feel what Jesus was going through. No illustration that can carry the weight. Any human analogy that we come up with only takes away from the darkness and the bitterness that Jesus goes through. Somehow in that one moment, Jesus experienced separation from the Father in hell. Because that's what hell is. Aside from all the imagery that we've seen on TV and stuff, we use fire and all these things to describe hell. Hell is complete separation from God and his ways. And that's what Jesus experiences in this moment. I always thought growing up that what made Jesus' death so terrible was the physical horrors of the cross. And they are terrible. But that's not in this moment what makes Jesus stagger and sweat. It's the personal disconnection from his Father. This is the horror of the cross for him. That's why I think the gospel writers don't go into much detail about the physical aspects of the crucifixion. They don't have much detail. Because the physical suffering, as horrendous as it was not the full comprehensive essence of what the cross was about. The essence of the cross was that in this ordeal, Jesus was abandoned by God. The word Gethsemane, the garden where this happened, means oil press. And that's what's happening. The reality of God's judgment against our sin is pressing not on us, but on Jesus. It's squeezing the life out of him. He knelt down in prayer and got a sudden but overwhelming glimpse of the power, the wrath of God, and he almost died immediately. And we see praise these three times. Father, if there's any other way, let this cup pass from me. Had Jesus at this point ever prayed a prayer that had not been answered? No. He was so utterly in tune with God's will that he prayed for things that he knew God wanted. They were of one. And yet here he tells God, and in effect us, that on one level he doesn't want this. Because who would? Now, why the cup? Back in the Old Testament, the cup was a symbol for judgment. Imagine what's going on here is imagine God's wrath against our sin, God's anger at our sin, our wrongdoing, our bad attitude to him. Imagine it's like a toxic poison kept in a cup. And imagine that cup is being served to us as we deserve. And Jesus steps in the way, stretches out his hands, drinks the cup for us right down to the last dregs, every drop. That's exactly what happens. Our salvation, we say this pretty much every week, our salvation was something only God himself could accomplish. But why? You might wonder, there's still this question. Why does Jesus begin to experience it at this moment? He's not physically on the cross. Why this moment? Why not wait until he's attached to the cross, he's nailed on, before this particular torment of separation from the Father begins? I think this is why. And it's on the screen because I think it's important. Jesus experienced something of the extensive trauma of the cross before he was nailed to it so that he and we could see the extent of the price he would have to pay to get us at a point when he still had a choice. He has to begin experiencing this at the point when he still has a choice. He has a choice. He faces up to the blackest darkness and isolation you can possibly imagine. And it was do this and get us, or not do this and not get us. That was the choice. He had the choice and he chose to do it. That was the choice and he chose to do it. I'm just going to let you sit with that for a moment. Got three reflections on this passage. First one, let Jesus be your model. One thing that people who don't know much about Jesus do is say, wow, you know, what a great moral teacher. What a fine human being. What a lovely person. And as Christians, we realize that he's a lot more than that. But sometimes because of that, we lose that Jesus is also the example of how to live your life. In this passage, I think he does something that challenges how many people go about making decisions. Very often, when Christians, I've observed, good Christian people have a decision to make, a big decision maybe, or a situation to deal with, they might say something like, well, I felt a peace about it. I felt a peace about it. Now, I bought myself a bigger house and I felt a peace. I spent more money on nice things for me and I felt a peace. I blanked that person who's annoying me. And guess what? I felt peaceful about it. I felt good. It was easier. In other words, because I felt better, it was the right decision. And the culture that we live in is all about this. If it feels right, then it is right. Right? Now, this is tricky because God sometimes does give us a peace in hard situations. That's true and that's amazing. But let me put it to you. If Jesus made the most selfless decision ever and explicitly did not feel peaceful about it, maybe how you and I feel is not the best measure of whether a decision is good or not. Maybe how you and I feel is not the best measure of whether a decision is good or not. Maybe the measure for good decision making is what Jesus would do or the attitude Jesus would have, not whether you feel good. And maybe right now you're dealing with something and option A makes you feel good and option B makes you feel less good. And so option B, A is very appealing. If that's you right now, how about applying the Jesus filter? Which decision adds up best with his ways? Think of it like this. If Jesus made decisions only around feeling a peace, you and I would be eternally condemned. If he made decisions only around feeling a peace, you and I would be eternally condemned. Good job that he made the decision based on selfless love instead, isn't it? That's the model. That's the model. Second thing, let Jesus be your reassurance. If you're experiencing some sort of darkness right now, we have a God who can 100% relate. No other worldview, no other explanation of human reality offers this whatsoever. Without God, we are fully and completely on our own when it comes down to it. But with him, we have an advocate and companion who will stay with us in the worst moment and beyond the grave. He's already done something harder than stay with you in your worst moment. The fantastic and sadly recently deceased author Tim Keller puts it like this. When Jesus Christ was in the Garden of Gethsemane and the ultimate darkness was coming down on him, and he knew it was coming, he didn't abandon you. He died for you. If Jesus Christ didn't abandon you in his darkness, the ultimate darkness, why would he abandon you now in yours? Of course he wouldn't. Whatever your darkness, whether it's self-inflicted problems or bad stuff happening around you or mental health challenges and feeling alone, Jesus resolutely will not abandon you. He's utterly trustworthy. He dies for the disciples who slept through his worst moment. Whatever you do or have done will not make him waver. And third thing, final thing, let Jesus be your amazement. How incredible, how astonishing that God, the God, went through what happens in this passage. And you know, some people like to say, well, you know, all this Jesus stuff, all well and good, but God's kind, God's loving. He's nice, surely. There must be lots of ways that people get into right relationship with him, right? Why not? There was no other way to save us. This was the only way. Jesus did it. More heroic than anybody else in history or even any made-up story. Can you think of a greater insult to Jesus than to say there were multiple ways of rescuing humanity? That there are lots of ways to God? Is there any worse thing to say to Jesus? That he looked at God his Father and said, if there's any other way, let this cup pass from me. And there were other ways, and God just didn't tell him. Obviously not. Let's not act like we are more loving than Jesus. Let's stop debating the method and acting like we've got good theological and philosophical ideas. Let's just stand amazed. Think of it in terms of that great song we sometimes sing in church, and I think we're going to sing today. I stand amazed in the presence of Jesus the Nazarene, and I wonder how he could love me, a sinner condemned unclean. For me, it was in the garden. He prayed, not my will, but thine. He had no tears for his own griefs, but sweat drops of blood for mine. He took my sin and my sorrow and made them his very own. He bore my burden to Calvary and suffered and died alone.